Okay, so how did the exam go? No reaction. Easy, difficult. Anything, any comments at all?
Wasn't horrible.
Okay. Alright, anything, any other comments? Wasn't horrible is a compliment for most of these exams. Okay, so I haven't actually started grading anything yet. I am traveling, next week is Thanksgiving week, so I'm traveling quite a bit. I hope to return it the week after Thanksgiving. Okay, just keep that in mind. We will try to hand out your second project hopefully next week, because that was due, was handed in last week. So that we will hand out, the exam will hand out the week after next. I did put up the third project already. For people who want to get an early start or want to spend your Thanksgiving break catching up on the coursework, you can do that. I mean, technically it should have been like a 2 week assignment, two and a half week assignment. It's due on December 10th, so there's plenty of time to get it done. Yes, I just put it up a week in advance just to give you the option of starting early on it. I'll talk a little bit about that today. Okay? Well, the class is very sparsely attended today. Nevertheless, I will give some background on it towards the end of the class. Okay, so let's get started here. So I just want to finish up a couple of pending slides from the distributed security discussion from last time. And then we will talk about distributed file system, new topic that we are going to start today. So remember that last time we basically spent a lot of time talking about authentication, using digital signatures and so on. Okay? And I ended the discussion with application case studies. So we looked at secure email. How do you send encrypted email? How do you sign the email digitally, so that you know it has actually been sent by whoever claimed to send it? How do you make sure the email was not modified in transit using digests and signing the hashes and whatnot? Okay. The second application I want to talk about is Kerberos. Okay. So Kerberos is basically a distributed security application that allows a client to set up a secure connection with the server using session keys. Okay. So you use session keys and use those keys to generate establish a channel with the server. Okay. So this picture shows you Alice and Alice's workstation. The workstation, let's say, wants to log in into some other remote service. Okay. To do that, Alice's workstation and this remote server need to agree on some session key. And Kerberos allows you to get those session keys. And the way it works is there are two entities in Kerberos. There's something called authentication service, which provides the login service for a distributed system. And there's a ticket granting service, which, and tickets are essentially the mechanism that you use to convince the server that you're trying to log into that you are an authentic client, that you are authenticated. Okay? And the nice thing about Kerberos is it has this notion of a single sign-on. Okay, once you log in into your system, once, okay, you can use that sign on to access any other service without having to repeatedly provide your password. Okay, right now, if you don't have Kerberos, if you want to access your, let's say, email, okay, you may have to provide your email, in your client has to provide your login name and password to access your IMAP server, for instance. You want to then SSH in, you have to provide another login name and username and password. They may be the same, but for every machine or every service you want to access, you have to repeatedly provide the username and password, even if they're identical. Okay, because each of them might look up the same username password, but they don't know that you're authenticated somewhere else. What Kerberos allows you to do is it allows you to authenticate yourself once to the system, and you get some credentials, and by presenting that credential to any service that is Kerberized, you can then just access that service without having to repeatedly authenticating you. That's the advantage of Kerberos. Otherwise, the SSH mechanism works fine, just avoids the trouble of doing this repeatedly. Okay? So the way it works is you basically, the steps are numbered. So you say you want to log in, and then you go to the authentication service and say, I am Alice. What comes back to you is essentially a key that Alice is going to use to talk to the ticket granting service, which is TGS, and then there is a encrypted message which says this is Alice and this is the session key for Alice's workstation to talk to the ticket granting service. Okay. So at this point, so that's step 3, and then the workstation will ask Alice for a local password. Okay. So Alice provides a password to the workstation. Okay. This password is used locally, so it's never sent over the network, it's only used locally. And then what happens is you use the key that had come to you. Okay, so you take this message, okay, and you send it to the ticket granting service, and you generate a local session key with this password. Okay, this password is known to the workstation, it's known to the ticket granting service, but it is actually never sent over the network. That's an advantage of this, because if you are not sending any passwords over a network, there is nothing to for an intruder to get hold of. So you use the password locally to generate this key which is mentioned here. So you send this encrypted message from the authentication service. You say, I want to log into this machine B, here is a local session key. So then the ticket granting service actually comes back with a ticket, which is basically saying, okay, here is KAB is the session key that Alice and that other machine Bob have to use. And then this is the encrypted version of the message. Okay? And this is the message that you are going to then use to send to Bob for the same session key. Okay? So essentially what has happened is there are two entities. In the first one, you basically ask for a ticket, which is what you use. So this ticket is essentially this key. Okay? Which you go to the ticket granting service, say I want to log into Bob and Bob's machine. And then you basically get another key that you are going to go and use to access that machine. Okay, and so if you want to now log into yet another machine, you will use the same ticket that you already have. Okay, and go to the ticket granting service saying, let me access this other machine, and then you get another. So at that point, you don't have to provide your password again. Okay, because you already have the one-time session key that you have generated. So you basically log in once. Okay, and this allows you to access any machine on the network. Because it gives you the credentials to do this. That's the basic idea behind Kerberos. So there are lots of Unix-based environments that are based on Kerberos that use this mechanism. Okay? So essentially get this ticket. The other thing I should mention is this ticket, one-time key that you generated has an expiration time. So all of these tickets have an expiration time. It could be set to whatever your administrator wants, maybe 2 hours, 5 hours. And until it expires, okay, you don't have to authenticate your credentials. Once your ticket expires, then if you try to log in somewhere, it will re-prompt you for the password, saying the ticket you generated has expired because it has an expiration time. So it's not like a perpetual ticket that once you log in once and you can use it for arbitrary amounts of time. Okay, there's an expiration associated with it. Until it expires, you don't have to enter your password again. That's the basic point. Okay. So that's Kerberos. The third thing I wanted to mention was how all of these mechanisms we have talked about, encryption and authentication, are used in electronic payment system. Okay. There are many different electronic payment systems that are out there. I am going to talk about a specific one called eCash. It's not widely used, but it is something to just to consider, okay, as how one can use these principles to have a digital version of cash. Okay. To understand that, let's understand how transactions work in the traditional world. Okay. So here there is a payer and a payee. They want to enter into a transaction and the payer wants to make a payment to the payee. Okay. So you could use cash to do this, you could use a check, you could use a credit card. Okay. If you want to use a cash, then the payer has typically gone to his bank, withdrawn some money, and then you want to enter into a transaction and just give that money to the payee, get some goods or service in return, and the payee deposits into their bank. Okay, so very simple. Cash is easily understood. This is how checks work and that's how credit cards work. Okay, we sort of understand intuitively how this works. The payer's bank issues checks to the payer. Okay, payer writes out a check, hands it over to the payee. Payee cashes the check by going to their bank. Okay, and then there's a protocol between the payer's bank and the payee's bank, which is called a settlement process. Okay, so this check is then presented by the payee's bank to the payer's bank saying, your customer wrote this check. Okay, so please give me this much money. Okay, so then So that's the order transfer, and then during the settlement process, money is actually transferred from the payer's bank to the payee's bank, and then it is credited to the payee's bank account. Okay, this is how checks actually work. Okay, the credit card process is somewhat similar. Okay, except that you don't write anything on a piece of paper, you use transactions in the system to do the payment. So the payer's bank has issued a credit card to the payer. Okay. To make a payment, the payer presents this credit card to the payee and says, I am willing to pay X for this goods or service. Okay, the payee basically then gives an instruction to the payee's bank saying, here is a credit card, charge so much. Okay, this is typically done using a credit card terminal. Okay, so you swipe this credit card, but what essentially happens is that credit card terminal is connected to a bank's processing system. So you electronically tell your bank saying, here's a credit card, charge so much on this credit card. Okay? So then the payee's bank and the payer's bank enter into the same kind of settlement process. Usually there may be an intermediary, okay, in this process. There doesn't have to be one, but usually there may be an intermediary like Visa or MasterCard, which actually act as the clearinghouse. So all of this settlement might occur through the intermediary. You send all your transactions there and that intermediary sends it to the bank. Or you could do a direct settlement. Okay, you can say, here's the card that you issued, this is the amount. So in the settlement process, money is transferred back. Okay? So this is basically how traditional payments work. Okay? Now we want to design an electronic payment system, which basically has some of the advantages of paying in cash. Okay? Paying by check and paying by credit card requires the payer to provide some information to the payee. Okay? So in this case, you basically reveal your identity. Depending on who you are, your credit card has your name on it, your check might have your name on it and your bank's name on it. When you enter into a transaction with cash, there is a lot of anonymity. Okay, you're just paying cash, the payer doesn't have to reveal their identity to the payee. Okay, you're just giving money, and the payee knows that this money basically is what it is. So if you wanted to do this electronically, okay, but not use either check or credit card, which does not have the same level of anonymity, how could you do that? Okay, that's basically what this e-cash process works. Okay, so you want to do something like have the convenience of a credit card, but don't want to have the disadvantage of sort of saying who you are. Okay, so here is how it works. So the payer, okay, essentially has to generate a coin. Okay, this is basically, let's think of it as a number, which says this is X dollars. Okay, so it's X dollar coin. Okay? And then you have to go to your bank and try to anonymize the coin. So this is called the blinding process. Okay, so you say $10, you send this to the bank. The bank basically signs off on it, saying, okay, this is $10, and it also basically blinds it. Okay? So what the think of a blinding process as follows. So if you if it is a check, okay, you put the check into an envelope, okay, and then the bank actually signs on this envelope saying enclosed is $10, and I guarantee that there are $10 in there. Okay. So in some sense, the bank does not keep track of what this coin is. Okay, otherwise, the bank would actually know who generated the cash. This is very similar to you go to an ATM, you withdraw money, the bank has dispensed notes. Okay? But the bank doesn't know which $20 bill you have. Okay? Although it dispenses it to you, it is not tracking this. It has just given you the money. When you go and enter into a transaction with someone else, this is not tracked, cannot be tracked by the bank, neither does the payee know who you are. Okay? So if you want to preserve the same properties, you want to withdraw money from your bank electronically using this notion of e-cash, and then just as a physical cash serial number on each note. You want a serial number on each coin, but you don't want the bank to be able to track it. Okay, so this is the blinding process. So what that means is you basically have this unique ID. It's equivalent to putting it into an envelope, and the bank actually certifies that this is money that it will accept. Okay, but it is not tracking the unique number. So that's the blinding process. So you send the blinded coin, the bank signs the blinded coin, and it comes back to you. And then you can go to the payee and says, here are $10. Okay? And all that the payee has to do is verify the signature that the bank has, the digital signature of the bank, saying is this valid $10 or is it counterfeit. Okay? So if the bank has actually signed off on it, you can verify that such and such bank actually signed, digitally signed it, so you know it is legitimate money, okay, not counterfeit. Okay. So then you can just accept it based on that signature, and later on you can actually go back to the bank and say I want money for this. Okay, or you can use this to enter into other transactions. So this is basically the notion of electronic cash, okay, that people actually came up with. Now, as I said, although this protocol for doing all this exists, okay, and it requires you to do digital signatures and blinding, anonymization here and signatures here, and we know at least how to do the signature part. But it has not been used widely, okay, because there are other mechanisms that seem to provide the same level of benefit. Like PayPal is a good example of how you can make anonymous payments. Okay, not completely anonymous, but you don't have to reveal sensitive information like your credit card number to a merchant that you may not trust. Okay, you go through an intermediary that you trust, okay, and you provide the information to the intermediary makes payment. Okay. So you can reveal, you don't have to reveal all the information. Okay, you might still have to reveal your name and so on, which, so it doesn't give you all of the benefits of eCash, but it gives you some of the benefits, saying I don't have to, if I'm doing a transaction on the internet, this is a merchant I've never heard of, I don't have to give them their credit card number and then have some problems later on. Okay? So those seem to be enough to for people to be able to do transactions. So this notion of completely anonymous electronic transactions haven't really become very popular, yeah, as a result of this. Any questions on notion of electronic cash? Okay, the book has some more material on how some of this. I haven't actually said exactly what protocol is used for the blinding and unblinding. There is a slide on this which I'm going to skip, which gives you the whole protocol, but you don't have to know this for the purpose of this class. If you have interest, then you can go and look at the protocol itself. Yes, question.
Why does this claim need a serial number? Can you just give a signature to the payee saying this signature says the bank will give you $20?
Yeah, so you don't necessarily need a serial number. Okay, all you need are two properties. One is you shouldn't be able to duplicate it. So if I have a $10 thing, right, this is basically a bunch of, it's a file, let's say, or an attachment. You shouldn't be able to go to two merchants and present it. Okay, this is like I have a $10 bill, I make a photocopy of the bill and I give this two $10 bills to two merchants. You need to be able to figure out that this cannot be duplicated. That's one problem, that the bank has to figure that out. So if there isn't an identifier, if it just says here is $10, okay, but there's no way to track it whether this $10 differs from another thing that is here is another $10, then I can take this signed thing and make multiple copies and spend it at different merchants. So there has to be a way to associate that.
But the bank never saw this ID.
The bank has not. So that is part of the blinding process, which bank doesn't have to know that, but there is a way for the bank to track that. Okay. So you can take the blinded coin because there's a unique ID in there. Okay. You can basically then, if you give the same unique ID to two merchants, both merchants go to the bank knows that you spent it twice. Even though you have not seen the serial number, because the same serial number, you have signed the serial number, so this payer cannot change it because it's digitally signed by you. So if your payer goes and actually presents it to two different merchants, you know that it is being spent twice, so you can decline the second one. So there has to be a way for the bank to prevent the payer from committing fraud. That's the only thing, only property you want there, while preserving anonymity. So you don't see the serial number, but you know that there is one. And there is no way for the payer to forge the bank signature, because only the bank has the private key. So if you just sign a unique ID, and if the payer actually spends it twice, you can track that down. So those are all properties you want from the system.
So the payee just can't generate a different ID and say, oh, here's another $20 payee.
You can, but then you need a signature to go with it, right? So only the bank has the private key, so you can generate whatever you want, but you cannot force the bank signature on it.
You can't just pop that bank signature thing for $20?
No, the bank signature is like just as you could sign a MD5 hash. Okay, you give it a hash, so ID is like a hash. The bank has actually signed the hash. Right, so there's no way to forge that, because it's like just encrypt the hash using my private key. So there's no way I can repeat that process. So those are the properties you really want, which is why there's ID there. Any other questions or comments here? Okay, so it's just, that's basically all I want to say about security. And let's move on to the next topic, which is distributed file system. Okay. So this is basically going to be split across two classes. So today I'm going to give a quick overview of Unix-like file systems. Okay. And then we will talk about some quick issues that arise in distributed file system. And I'll illustrate most of this with several case studies. Okay. Today's case study is going to be NFS. Okay. Next time we are going to talk about not code, but it should be CODA. CODA and XFS, and in the context of XFS, there will be some discussion on log structured file systems as well. Okay. So that's basically the material that is going to be covered today and next Tuesday. Okay, so let's start with some basics. Okay. So as you are, you probably know what a file is. Okay. So formally, the definition that we will use in this class is a file is basically a named collection of logically related data. Okay. It's a data container. It contains some data, okay, and it has a name that a user can use to get access that file. Okay. As far as the file system is concerned, or as far as most file systems are concerned, they don't really care about what is the data itself. Okay. This is something that the user generates that's useful to them. It could be a data file. Okay. It could be an application binary that the file system doesn't care. Okay. For most file system, this data is just a sequence of bytes. Unix assumes that a file is essentially an uninterpreted sequence of bytes. So the file system doesn't even interpret what's in it. Okay? So as far as the file system is concerned, it's a bag of bytes and it has a name. Okay? Whenever the user presents that name, the file system knows that the user wants to access this data container. Okay? So what the file system is essentially doing is it's giving you a logical view of the data that you're storing on your storage system. Okay. Using a user-friendly interface. Okay. Users don't really need, at the file system abstraction level, a user doesn't need to worry about the internals of your file system. Are the files stored on a hard disk? Is the file stored on a USB stick? Is it stored on a CD-ROM? You don't need to know, you don't need to care. Okay. You are being given this nicer abstraction of files and folders or directories which you use to manipulate your data. Okay. The file system worries about how these bytes are mapped into disks and where, and are they stored on disks, and when you're given a file name, how do I figure out where these bits are stored on disk? All this is actually hidden from from the end user. Okay. This is why you're basically getting a higher level, logical, easier to use abstraction of your underlying storage device. So that's one thing that the file system does. Okay. The other two things it does, okay, in order to, in addition to allowing you to organize your files, which means create, modify, delete them, is it allows you to share your data in a controlled manner, and it allows you protection. Okay. Depending on what kind of access privileges you put on your files, your data may or may not be visible to other users on the system. Okay. And that basically allows you to do sharing and also protection. And by setting the right access privileges, you can protect certain pieces of data. So if you say your mail is private, you basically have the right permission bit, so nobody but you can access your mail files. Okay? You may be working on your programming assignment, so you can set access pattern bits so that you and your project partner could then access those files, but no one else. Because you can control who gets access to which files, okay, on a fairly fine, at a file level, at a directory level, and so on. Okay. So this is what most traditional file systems will do for you. Okay. So let me quickly review the Unix file system, okay, and then we'll talk about distributed file system. Okay. So I already said that in Unix, a file is essentially a linear array of bytes. Okay. It's not interpreted by the file system. File system doesn't even know about file types. Okay. Certain file systems will use the extension on the file name to figure out what type of a file it is. Is it a Word document? Is it a Java source code? Is it a PDF file? So the file system will actually know or try to interpret based on the extension. Traditionally, Unix file systems have not done that. Right? To them, the extension is basically a string. It doesn't matter. The what is in the file is also a sequence of bits. It is not interpreted.
Right.
So the, as I said, so this basically takes an extreme view where file system says you can store your files, you can have a name, okay? But the system will not interpret anything for you. Other file systems actually try to interpret at least the contents or the type of a file, okay? But Unix file systems don't. The directory is basically a folder which basically is a which allows you to organize your files on your disk. Okay? Directories may have other subdirectories, so you have this hierarchical namespace. I already talked about this when we did naming. Okay, what a file system namespace looks like. There's a root directory. There may be files in that root directory and certain subdirectories. Within each subdirectory, there may be other files and subdirectories and so on. You can have arbitrary levels of nesting, okay, through your file system. Okay. So let's now talk about what is actually in a directory. Okay, directory is essentially a table that allows you to map the file name to the contents of the file. Okay. And in the context of Unix, the way this is done is using a data structure called an inode, okay, or an index node. Okay, so index nodes or inodes are essentially what are called metadata for the file. Okay. So the file system has to have two types of information stored on disk: the data itself, which are the files that the user creates, and metadata. Metadata is information about the file: the name of the file, the user that created the file, the access power, bits on the file, the size of the file, last modified times of the file, the creation time of the file. All of this information that you see when you actually do list the contents of a directory is stored in the metadata part. Okay, the data part actually has the file contents itself. Okay. So the metadata is typically stored in what is called an inode in a Unix file system or an index node. Okay. And the way your disk is organized or any Unix file system is organized, so let's assume the disk is essentially a linear region that goes from 0 through n bytes. Okay, there's an n byte disk. So there's a special part of the disk that is called a super block. Okay. So all the metadata So all of the metadata is stored in the super block in a Unix file system. So the inodes essentially are stored linearly in the super block. So you can have inode 1, inode 2, and so on. Okay, and then here we actually have the files themselves. Okay. In large disks, you may have more than one super block. Okay, because you can have lots of files, so that for lots of files you will need lots of inodes. For each file there is an inode that tells you what is the file name and who is the user of the file and whatnot. Okay. So there is a special region, and as I said, in larger one there may be multiple super blocks that are spread across disks. They are stored at known locations. Okay. So that's the thing to keep in mind. So the location of the super block is always known, and the location of inodes is always known. Okay. Typically, as far as the file system is concerned, okay, it tries to access files using inode numbers. Okay. It doesn't really know anything about file names. File names are essentially strings that it uses to figure out what the inode is. So what your directory is essentially, okay, is a table which has records, which basically say here's the file name, here's the inode number for the file, here is file 2. This is basically a string that tells you what the name of the file is and the inode of the file. This is what is in a directory. Every directory is essentially this table, you know, Unix file system. Okay, it's a mapping from a string, which is the name of the file, to an inode number. Okay, that tells the file system what's the inode. Whenever the user tries to access this file, go to this inode and all the necessary information for that file is in that inode. Okay. And inodes themselves are stored in the super block. Okay. Directory is essentially a file like any other file. It's just a special kind of a file that tells you, gives you the mapping from a file name to an inode number. Okay? Yes, there's a question there.
Instead of having the inode number, why actually have the metadata in the directory file?
Okay, question is, why not have metadata in the directory file? I'll talk about the structure of the inode and it will become clear why you should not, why the decoupling is actually beneficial. Okay? So let's hold off on that for just 1 minute. Are there any other questions on this? Okay, so now let's talk about the inode itself. Okay, what are the contents of an inode? Typically, an inode itself will have some fixed size. Okay, let's say 128 bytes or 64 bytes. That is predetermined. Okay, and then you have the inodes all stored in this known region called the super block. Okay, and here is what the structure of an inode looks like. So you can have inode number, let's say the user ID of the file, some creation time, size, and so on. So there will be some of these entries. Okay. And then it has to have pointers to the data blocks on the file. Okay. So you have to keep track of where is the actual data on disk. Right. So this is basically, so the file has three blocks. Let's say block 1, block 2. There will be pointers here saying block 1 is basically this block, block 2 is this block, and so on. So there are these pointers that allow you to figure out where is the data actually stored on the file. So typically the way you access file is you open the file with the file name. So what the file system does is it looks up the directory and it gets the inode number. Then it goes to the super block and reads that inode from that super block. Okay. And then once you have the super block, then you know you have entries to where the data for this file is. So then if you start reading the file, you look up that entry. Okay. It points you to this region on the disk and you read this block. Or if you write the first block, you write at offset 0, you will actually go and write at this location on this. Okay, this is how you will actually access file in Unix. Okay. Now, as you know, files can have arbitrary sizes. Okay. So, depending on the size, okay, you will have certain number of data blocks allocated to the file. And this is essentially an array that maps the block number of the file to the disk location for that block. Okay. Now, since files can have arbitrary size, you can have a 2-byte file and you could have a 2-gigabyte file, they can have arbitrary numbers of blocks. Okay. So the size of this index can be arbitrary. Okay. It depends on how many blocks there are in the file. If the file has 7 blocks, there have to be 7 entries. If the block has 7,000 blocks, there have to be 7,000 entries in here. Okay? Is that clear? You have a question, Naresh. You have to keep all 7,000, but I'm going to discuss how to do that efficiently. Okay. Now, since the file can have arbitrary size, when you create a file, the file system does not know how large this file is going to be over its lifetime. Okay. So the file system does not really know how large this array is going to be. Okay. So then the question is, how many entries should you allocate in this array? If you don't know how large the file is going to be, it may not be very large or it could be very large, and the file system does not know, perhaps the user may not know. So user cannot tell the file system, create this file and allocate so many entries. So there is no easy way for the file system to deal with the issue of figuring out the size of a file. Okay, so you have to do this adaptively in any file system. Okay. So how would we go about? What would be a good way to do this? Okay. You can do empirical results. So empirically, if you look at a typical disk, you'll see that file sizes, the mean file size is probably somewhere in the 4K to 8K range. Okay. So the average file that is on your file system will have 1 to 2 blocks. Okay. So you can't really use this to make any decision. If you say on an average, it's fine for me to have 2 entries in this array, that doesn't work. Because you can create arbitrary files. Okay. Okay. So as and when you write data to the file, you decide. Okay. That's a good point. But then the question is data structure will have to keep growing. Okay. Because this is at a known location on disk, the way the file system is organized is you have to predetermine the size of the inode so that you can store them on known location. Okay, so if you say each file inode is 128 bytes in size, okay, then you store 128, first inode takes the first 128, second inode takes the second 128 bytes, and so on. Okay. So when you say this file is, let's say, inode 100, okay, I know precisely where that inode is on disk. Okay. That is basically offset 100 times the inode size, which is, let's say, 128. That's the byte offset where this inode is going to be stored. If inodes are a variable size, then you will need yet another table to know where inode 100 is stored, because each inode is a variable. If inodes are a fixed size, the computation of the offset is mechanical. You just take the inode size, you take the inode number, you get the byte offset. That's where inode is stored. So typically in the Unix case, inodes are actually a fixed size, they are not a variable size. Okay. If they are a fixed size, that limits the number of entries you can store here. Okay. So in particular, there is no way you can actually store 7000 entries when you are 128 byte. Each of this may be a 1 to 4 byte entry. Okay. But yet you want this adaptive behavior where files can grow to arbitrary sizes. So the way inodes are organized is it's a multi-level index. So the what that means is, let me draw the inode here.
So the index store has all the information like the metadata or the file.
Yes.
So instead of giving the pointers to the block of the file,
right,
it is pointing to, why doesn't we provide this facility to the blocks itself, point like the end of the block pointing towards the region where the next block is?
Okay.
That way we'll avoid all this information to be stored in a particular
Okay, that's a good point. So the point being made is, why bother? Okay, so one way to have adaptive sizes is just store one entry. Organize your file as a linked list. Okay, store the entry to the head of the list, which is exactly one entry always. And at the end of the file, put a pointer to the next block. Okay. So files can grow of arbitrary size. When you keep growing, you just keep adding blocks, and in the previous block you just pointed to the next block. This is how the DOS FAT file system is actually organized. It's a linked list. Okay. This is exactly what is done in, if you have FAT8 or FAT32, this is how it works. Okay. So the inode actually only has one entry. It's not an array. It's just a linked list organization where you point to the head and then each block points to arbitrary block. Now this is good from an inode perspective, because the file can be of arbitrary size, the inode is always fixed size because it only has a head of the list stored there. What it is not good for is random access. Okay, because this is a linked list, if you open a file and you do seek and you say I want to access byte offset something, if that is, let's say, in a 7000 block file, it is the 5000th block, the only way you can actually do this is you'll have to actually go read each block, because you don't know where this block is. So you have to read each block and follow the linked list. It's exactly what you do in a linked list. Okay, linked lists are not good for random access. Okay, if you want to, the ith entry, you have to start from the head and chase the pointers until you get to the ith entry. Okay, so random access is not good in, if you have a linked list organization. If you have an array organization, this is like a hash table. You just look up the ith entry, it directly gives you the block address. Okay, so random access is very efficient here. Okay. But the downside of this array can be of arbitrary size. You don't know ahead of time how many entries to allocate for it. Okay, so that's the difference. So you can do that, but then you will lose random access benefits. And some DOS actually, FAT file systems actually do exactly that. Okay. So the way, how do you get around this? Yes, question.
You have to have like maybe a pointer if it overflows the number of blocks to like another file entry.
Yeah. Right. So basically, you use exactly that organization. It's called a multi-level index. Okay. So this is your inode. So you can have, let's say, the first 10 entries as direct pointers. Okay. If your block, if your file size is less than 10 blocks in size, all you need to do is get the inode, and you have pre-allocated 10 entries. Okay. So your array is known to be of 10 entries at least. Okay. So the first 10 blocks, you can directly store block addresses here, no problem. Okay. If the file grows to the 11th block, okay, then you are going to overflow. You don't have enough entries. So what, there are three additional entries stored here. So if it grows to the 11th block, what you do is you basically now make this a multi-level, two-level index. Okay. So rather than directly pointing to this block, you allocate a block which itself will have, which is a disk block. It has 1024 entries. Okay. So basically this is a two-level array. So this pointer points to the next. So here you can actually store pointers to 1024 more blocks. Okay. This allows you to grow to 1034 in blocks. Okay. Files up to 1034 are fine here. Okay. So you can keep allocating entries here. If your file actually grows beyond 1034 blocks, then you have a double indirect. So here is yet another entry that basically points to a block. In each of these blocks will point to another index block. Okay, so it's a two-level index. So you point, go from here to here, here to here, and each of this will point to disk blocks. Okay. This allows it to go to 1024 square more entries, because each of this can blow into a index block that will point to additional blocks. Okay. Now, if you have, so your file can grow to 1024 square plus 1024 plus 10. Okay. And all these other blocks are allocated purely on demand. If the file is less than 10 entries, nothing to allocate. If it grows beyond 10, you just allocate this, but these entries are void, so you don't allocate any of this. Okay. So once it grows beyond this, then you allocate this block, and then you allocate the first double indirect block. If it goes beyond this, you allocate the second indirect block. So all these additional arrays are being allocated purely on demand for only files that are of that size. Okay. You don't have this large array that's pre-allocated. You are growing the array adaptively as the file grows. And if the file grows beyond 1024 square, then you have a triple indirect. Okay, so this will point to a block, each of that will point to another index block, each of that points to a third index block, and those point to block pointers.
So there is a maximum size, right?
Sorry?
There is a maximum size, right?
Yes, there's always a maximum size in any file system. Okay. So you can have a quadruple indirect also, which would allow you to have this quad. So that's the... So in this organization, that's the maximum number of blocks your file can have. Okay? That time the block size, which could be let's say 4K, is the maximum size of the file that your file system can support. If you actually try to allocate more than that, it will. So that's around a gig, I believe. Okay, but if you have second level, a fourth level of indirect, that will allow you to grow to hundreds of gig, I think, or some terabytes, which is reasonable for most files. You don't have more of that.
We can easily have a file over a gigabyte.
Yes, you can.
Like I have files over a gigabyte.
If you actually have a DVD, that's easily 6 gig.
Yeah.
Yes. So the modern file systems will have yet another level of indirect, which will allow you to grow to that size. Yeah. Yes, question.
So you need a pointer to every block for random access, but also files don't have to be contiguous, do they?
Files don't have to be contiguous. These are just block pointers, so these blocks can be anywhere on disk. Okay? And do realize that you do get random access. You want to get the, let's say, 1040th block, you just read this entry and you just go to that offset that gives you. You don't have to read all the blocks. Okay? It is just that the level of indirection you have to follow through to get to your blocks increases as the size of the file increases. So as files get larger, the assumption is you are willing to pay this additional penalty of multiple lookups to get your disk block. But they are still random. You can go to an arbitrary block just by looking up these arrays. Okay, there's just multi-level arrays. Okay, question, yes.
Is there one such
level for every directory? Or? This table, yes, there's one such for every directory. Exactly. I'll show you just in 1 second.
For random access, we need to access a particular block of the file. We need to do the linear search on all the addresses, right?
No, you don't need to do linear search. So if you want certain byte offset, okay, and that translate to a certain block number. So let's say you want to look up block number 100. Okay, you know that block number 100 is going to be in your single indirect. There are 10 entries here, so you need to go and look up the 90th entry here. So what you will do is you will read the inode, look up that entry that points to this disk block, you will read this disk block, you read the 90th entry. It's not linear. It's just an array lookup. Okay? So very quickly, if you actually... Okay, so here is... So if you do ls minus I on any Unix thing, it will actually show you. So these are that's the file name, that's the inode number actually of that file. So it shows you all the inodes that have been allocated. This doesn't actually allow you to read the inode, but there are tools that can actually allow you to read the inode and look at this data structure. So somebody asked whether this is done for each directory. So that is indeed true. So here is your directory. This is basically the table that you have. This does not show you the inode number, but this is showing you all of the files. Okay, internally for each of this file there's an inode number that you can see. Okay, so that table is maintained for every directory. Okay, any other questions on this? Always search done. So if you remember, then I had actually discussed this when we did naming. Okay, back in. So if you have, let's say, just a quick recap. So if you have home, this is the file you want to access. Okay, this is the file name. You start at the root directory. Okay, this is how you do the recursive name lookup. That's exactly what it is. So you start at the root directory. You read this file. Okay, and then you look for a string called home in this directory. That gives you the, sorry?
Is that linear search?
That's a linear search. Yeah. So it's a string.
Yeah.
So, but lookups are not going to be frequent. You do that once at open time. Okay. So you look for a string called home. That gives you the inode number. Okay. Then go and look up that inode. Okay. And that points to another table like this. Okay. Then you basically read that block and you look for a string called Shenoy. That's this directory called home. Look for a string called Shenoy in there. Okay, and that will give you yet another inode. Okay. So you go to the super block, read that inode. Okay. And that has a pointer to yet another table like this. So then you go and read that table, you look for a string called mail. Okay. And then that will give you another inode. At that point you actually got the inode for the file you are trying to open. From this point on, any additional reads you will just look up this array. But this one-time name resolution is done by the file system. So if you go back to that chapter, you will see that.
And is the size of the super block limited?
It is limited. When you actually format your file system the first time, okay, you can specify the size of the super block. And because it is limited, you have pre-allocated inodes for your file system. So the number of files you can create is also limited to the number of inodes you have allocated at file system creation time, at format time. Okay? If you just format by, there are defaults that are specified. So your format tool is going to use those defaults and pre-allocate super blocks with certain number of inodes. But both the number of files you can create is limited by the size of the super block and the number of inodes you have created in the super block. And the size of a file is limited by the number of entries you can have in the inode. Okay, there's block pointers that you can store in the inode. So both are limited. Okay. So this can be changed at creation time. This cannot be changed. This is a file system design parameter. The max size of a file is determined by what file system you are using. This you can change at format time. You can say I want these many inodes. It will pre-allocate empty inodes for you. Okay, yes,
when
question.
You said that large disks, there might be multiple super blocks.
Yes.
How do you know which super block to look at?
Okay, so for large disks, there are multiple super blocks. So it's actually one super block that is spread across disk. Okay, just for reliability reason, just in case the file system corruption and this block becomes corrupt, you don't want all of your files to disappear on it. So what it does is it takes a large super block, it chops it into logically smaller super blocks and just stores them at known location. So every, let's say, 100,000 block is designated as a super block and it stores inodes. And it's a linear sequence, so you exactly know which super block, which logical super block to look in. But that's just an organizational issue. You could have just stored the super block at the beginning. In this case, it would be one giant super block. Okay, so that's how it works. Any other questions on this? Okay, so I spent more time on the Unix thing than what I wanted to do, which was the distributed file system. So let's talk about DFS and NFS specifically. So this is what a traditional Unix-like file system does. Okay. Now if you want to access, so it's fine to access this file locally. Okay, but if you want to access the files that are stored on one machine from another machine, you need the notion of a distributed file system. What a DFS does, it allows a client to access a file, any file that is stored on some server, which is a different machine. Okay. So there are always two components, okay, which is the client and the server. Okay. And in the case of a DFS, we will distinguish between the file service and the file server. Okay. The file service basically is the API that your file system is exposed for someone else to access. And depending on which file system you are using, the service may be different. So if you use NFS, you would use the NFS API. If you use Samba, which is what you use on Windows, then you use the SMB API to access files. Okay, you can use AFP, which is Apple's implementation of a distributed file system. Okay, so this API will change. Okay, and the file server is just the machine where this file service is running. Okay, so file server may have multiple services running. The same set of files could be exported over NFS, could be exported over Samba, and the clients can use any service they want to access that file. Okay, so the server can run multiple services depending on what type of APIs you want to expose. That's something to keep in mind. Okay, so in modern file systems, the directory service may be separated from the file service. Okay? There may be a separate machine called a metadata controller. Okay, when we do XFS, you will see this, that allows you to just do directory lookups. Okay, so directory lookups are separated. They could actually be on a separate machine. Okay, inodes could be stored on a separate machine. Data could be stored on a separate machine for scalability reasons. Okay, so there can be a decoupling of this. Okay, in a traditional file system, you don't do that. Both are on the same disk and you just have an API to access both. Okay, but in very large file system, the files and the metadata may be separated, may be stored on different machines. Okay, so here are two canonical ways of accessing remote files. Okay, so this is called the remote access model. This is called the upload-download model. Okay, the remote access model, the client just sends requests to the server for pieces of the file that it wants to access, and those pieces are returned back to the client. So you can say, I want to open this file and give me the 10th block. Okay, then the 10th block is returned to you. Then you say, I want the 13th block, and the 13th block is returned to you. The file always stays on the server. All of this is done using some network mechanism like RPCs. NFS, for instance, uses RPCs to do this. Okay, so you can request arbitrary chunks of the file from the client. Okay. In the upload-download model, what happens is when you want to open the file, okay, you first download a copy of the file to the client, the entire file. Okay. You do all the operations locally. When the file is closed, if the file has been modified, then you transmit the changes back to the server. Okay? While you are modifying this file, the server actually still has the old version of the file. So if some other client wants to access it, it will get the old version. Okay? So changes are done locally. There is no communication between the client and the server except at file open and file close time. At file open time, the file is brought over, all reads and writes are local. And at file close time, if the file was returned to, you send it back. Here that's not the case. Every read and write is actually serviced by the server directly. You just send a call, the server will either read the chunk, or if you write to it, it will update the disk. Okay. So these are two canonical models. Okay. NFS, actually the traditional NFS has used this model, but we'll see that NFS, the newest version of NFS, also supports this. And there are pros and cons. Okay, so here sharing across machines becomes easier because all operations are done at the server. Any write by one client is immediately visible to another client. Okay, so sharing is simpler. Here one file client will be writing, but the other client will have to access the old file until this file is closed. Okay, so you can share files, but if there are readers and writers, you will actually have old contents being read by some machines and newer contents being available at others. Okay. So there is that problem. Okay. The other advantage of that model is it is more efficient. If once you bring the file over, okay, all reads and writes will see higher performance because they are hitting the local disk. Here reads and writes have to go over a network hop. Okay. So reads and writes will be slower than reading a local disk. But reading a remote disk is always going to be slower than reading a local disk. Okay. Because the remote disk involves a network hop plus a local I/O. Okay. And reading a local disk is just local I/O. Okay. So performance seen by reads and writes is going to be worse than in that model. Okay. Yes, question.
So there's no notion of a transaction here.
There's no notion of a transaction. These are reads and writes. Okay. There are file systems that layer transactional semantics on top of open and close. We'll talk about file semantics in just a moment. But traditionally file systems don't do that. These are not databases, they're just files. Any other questions on this? Okay. So the other dimension for a distributed file system is whether the file server itself is stateful or stateless. Okay. In a stateless server, there's no information being kept at the server about which clients are accessing files, which files are open. None of that is kept at the server. All of this information is kept at the client end. As opposed to that, in a stateful server, you know precisely which clients are accessing which files are open and so on. And you have the usual advantages and disadvantages. Stateless file servers are more robust to failures. If the file server crashes and reboots, no information is lost because there was no state kept at the server. Here, if the file server reboots, you lose all information about which clients had open files. So that's a disadvantage. On the other hand, the advantage of a stateful file server is it makes cache consistency easier. If two machines are accessing the files, the same file, and you know about which are these two machines, if one of them sends a write to you, you can tell the other one, assuming it's employing caching, you can tell the other one saying this file has changed. You know, because you know who is accessing which file. In stateless servers, you don't know which clients are accessing what files. So if some client changes a file, you cannot tell others. Okay? It's a responsibility of the clients to implement some form of consistency. The server cannot help because it doesn't have any information. Okay? So consistency is easier in the stateful case, and it's harder or has to be client-based in the stateless servers. Okay? These are the usual advantages and disadvantages of stateful versus stateless. Okay? So with that background, which is whether the client and the servers keep state and whether you use upload and download, let's look at NFS. And we'll see that there are different versions of NFS that use combinations of the two. Okay? There are newer versions of NFS server that are stateful, older versions that are stateless. Okay? Newer versions support upload, download, the old versions use remote access. Okay? So in particular, we are going to do a case study of NFS version 3. That's the most widely used or deployed implementation of NFS right now, and NFS version 4, which is a newer implementation, but there are not a whole lot of them that are actually out there. Okay. If typically you have a Linux machine and you are using NFS, you are going to be using NFS version 3 by default. Okay. So we'll look at version 3 and version 4. Versions 1 and 2 we will ignore. Okay. So this is the architecture of NFS. Okay. There's a client machine, there can be an arbitrary number of them, and there's a server machine. The basic idea is the server has a disk with some files that it wants to make available to the client machine. Okay. And this is how the system is actually built. Okay. Typically, the client accesses these files, and as far as the applications are concerned, they don't have to care about whether the files are local or remote. Okay. They just provide a file name, let's say it could be this kind of file name. Okay. It's up to the file system to figure out, is that a local file or is that a file that is actually stored on a remote machine. So file names don't reveal in NFS whether the file is local or remote. They just look like the usual file names. So it's easier to deal with at the application and you don't have to worry about it. Okay. So now you are presenting a string to the file system saying open this file. The file system has to figure out is this local or remote. Okay. Typically you do name resolution, and what the layer at which this happens is called the VFS layer or the virtual file system layer. This is a level of abstraction that is implemented in any Unix-like system, which allows you to plug multiple file systems into the OS kernel. Okay, so whenever you can have arbitrary number of file systems supported on any OS. Okay, so for instance, if you have a USB stick, right, it typically has a FAT form file system on it, okay, which is an old DOS file system. Your OS has to support access to a FAT file system. It may have to support whatever your local disk is. Okay, if it's Linux, it may be ext3. Okay? If you have a CD-ROM, it has an ISO file system on it. Okay? And you may have a distributed file system. So typically any modern OS, okay, will have a support for up to a dozen or more different file systems. Okay? And the way all of them plug into the system is using this virtual file system layer. So each file system plugs into this layer, okay? And when calls come in, you figure out what type of a file system is it. If it's a FAT file system, you hand that call to the FAT implementation in the kernel. If it's an NFS file, you hand that to the NFS client code in the kernel. If it's a local disk, which may be ext3, this will forward that to the ext3 code in the kernel. Okay? So this is basically a large, think of it as a large if statement. So if file system type is NFS, then just forward this open request to the open implementation in the NFS client, okay, open file implementation. If this is ext3, then forward that to the open implementation in ext3. This is why it's called a virtual file system. It's not a real thing, it's just a forwarding layer that just forwards. Okay. So assume that it is a remote file, in which case your code is going to traverse through the NFS client. Okay, so it arrives at the NFS client. The NFS client uses RPCs. Okay, so it is going to make an RPC call to do an open to the server. Okay, this RPC call, so there's a stub here. So that stub will send that RPC call there. It arrives at the NFS server code. Okay, that's a code in the kernel that's running at the server. So this is open. Okay, so this server is actually going to send, so this is a local file here. So it is going to send the call back to the virtual file system layer, and then the virtual file system layer sends it, forwards it back to the local file system code there. Okay? And that is actually going to do whatever you asked it to do, open, read, write, and then the results are actually sent backwards and along the reverse path. This is basically how NFS works at an architectural level. Okay, so communication between the client and server uses RPC. Okay. Within the kernel, you use the virtual file system layer to forward the calls to the right clients. Okay. At this client end, everything goes to NFS, it arrives at the NFS server, and then goes back to the local file system for processing, and vice versa. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so these are some typical calls that the RPC calls that I mentioned. This is basically a list of all of them that the NFS client code and the NFS server code support. Okay? And most of them will be familiar to you. Right? Create creates a new file. Open will open a file. There is a read somewhere. Okay, there's a read and a write here. Here are set attribute, get attribute that allow you to change permission bits and whatnot. Okay? And there are two columns here. So this is the description of each of them. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of these, but only a few. There are two columns. This is the set of calls that are supported by version 3, and there's a set of calls supported by version 4. Okay? Now, the thing to keep in mind is NFS version 3 is a stateless server. It doesn't keep track of what clients are accessing the files, which files are open. None of that is tracked. NFS version 4 is a stateful server. It actually keeps track of which files are open, which clients have opened them, and so on. Okay? That results in some differences on which calls are supported and which ones are not. In particular, here is the open call to open a file. You will see that NFS version 3 does not support the open call. Okay? NFS version 4 does support the open call. And there's a reason for this. Any ideas on what open does and why version 3 doesn't support it? Yes.
Well, version 3 is stateless, doesn't need open call. It's all it knows when you read, it reads, when you write, it writes.
Yes.
And version 4 is stateful, has to know who has a connection to open, who has that file open.
Yes.
And has to coordinate.
So you are exactly right. So what does open do? Open does two things. Okay, when you open a file, you have to first check whether this application or this process has access permissions of the file. Okay, if the bits are the set in a way that doesn't allow it, the open call has to fail, and you don't have sufficient permission. And if you have sufficient permission, then the second part of open actually creates a state in the kernel. You get a file descriptor back. Right? This file descriptor is essentially the state that the OS has kept on behalf of you. From this point on, any read or write call have to use this file descriptor to say this is the file I'm interested in accessing, reading or writing. Okay. Now, since NFS version 3 does not have any state, there is no file descriptor. Okay. What that also means is that every time you do a read and write, okay, you have to do these checks, saying do I have access on this file or not, because there is no state. Okay. If you actually kept state, you do this permission checks once and only once, which is at open time. Once you open this, all reads and writes just go and access the file directly. But there is no state at the server. So I don't know when a read call comes whether you have access to this file or not. So every read or write call actually has to do this check repeatedly at the server end. Okay, so So that there's good and bad things. So one, you don't have to do the open. Okay? But you can, there is also a lookup call. Okay, which you, so what happens in version 3 is when you issue a file open, NFS, the NFS client code is actually going to do a lookup for you. Okay, so it doesn't do an open, but it does do a lookup, which is supported, which does that name resolution. Okay, on your behalf, and you can do the check at open time, do you even have access permission. But even after the open, every read, subsequent read and write call will have to present all of these credentials back to the server saying, I do have permissions. Okay. So the lookup call, essentially, if you have permissions, returns what's called a cookie. Okay. Which is similar concept to your web cookie. Web cookies on your browsers are used to store server state on your local disk. Every time your browser goes back to it, can present this cookie, which tells some the server, this is what you did last. Okay. You can track things using the cookie. Same thing is done here. You, once you do a lookup, if you have access to this file, this thing returns back a magic cookie. Subsequent read and write call can present this magic cookie to avoid a lookup on each request. Or if you don't have the cookie, then you have to re-trigger a lookup to say, do I have permissions on it? Okay? So this is how version 3 works, which is why there's no open call. All you do when the file is opened is you just say, do you have access to the file? If so, get a cookie. In subsequent operations, you use that cookie to access it and avoid doing lookups every time. Yeah, but you can trigger it if you want to. Version 4 actually does support open, so it can keep state. Okay, so you can keep the equivalent of file descriptors and whatnot. Okay. So that's the implication of being stateful and stateless, okay, in the file system. Okay, so you, what this also says is, if you look at the create call there, okay, there is no create in version 4, but there is a create in version 3. Okay. Typically, when you open a file, if that's the first time you're opening a file, the file system will also create the file for you. Okay. Because there is no open call here, okay, the NFS client code has to somehow do a lookup, and if this file doesn't exist, this open call has to create a file at the server. Okay, that's how your local file system works, which is why there is a create there that is used for you. Okay. But in version 4, since you explicitly have an open call, you don't need the create call. You'll just do the lookup, and if the file is not there at the server, you will use the open call itself to create the file, which is why that is not supported there, but it is supported here. Okay, these are some differences that you have to keep in mind, okay, because of the way the systems are architected. Yes, question.
Why aren't Linker and Luther supported in version 4?
Why are
Makedir
here?
Makedir and Remover.
So why are Makedir and Remover not supported? I think they are emulated using other calls. And I'm not sure which other calls they use. It's a good question. There are some other calls that used to implement this functionality. Let me look that up. I don't know what the call is, but of course you can create directories and read directories. That's not the issue. The issue is how do you do it. I will look that up. Okay, but this is not an exhaustive list. There are lots of other calls. It's just a sample. So let me get back to you on that. Any other questions?
This is also a regular non-regular file.
Yeah. Okay, what's the difference between a regular and a non-regular file? So regular files are files that you know about. Okay, these are data containers. But in Unix, you have all these other non-regular files like pipes, devices. These are not real files. They are other things that you access using an abstraction of a file. Okay? So you can actually create these things called non-regular files, which could be device files or pipes, named pipes that you can use to transmit information. So that's what you do. Okay, Unix has this notion of a non-regular file for everything that's not a file but just looks like a file. Any other questions? So if you go to /dev on any Unix machine, that's the devices directory. All of the entries there are actually hardware devices that you can access using files. So all of those are non-regular files in the file system. Okay. So I talked about opening a file. So this is basically when you do an open, you do a lookup, and then you use the magic cookie to do a read. Okay? And version 4 also has this thing called a compound RPC. Okay? Here the lookup is one RPC and the read is another RPC. So in the NFS version 4, for performance optimization, you can batch multiple RPC requests in a single message, which is called a compound RPC, a compound procedure. So you can actually do a lookup, open and read all in one call. So you can say, look up this file. If this file exists, then open the file and then read the first block. Okay, so all of this can be done. So it prevents you from sending multiple round trip requests, which will slow down the server. Okay, it's a performance optimization. So multiple NFS operations or RPC operations can be done using one single call. Okay, and you can batch arbitrary things. Doesn't matter what it is. Just called a compound RPC where you send multiple requests all at once. Okay, you batch them. Okay, so I talked about mount protocol during when we discussed naming, but let me again illustrate what that means. Okay, so here is the server. This is the namespace. These are the files that it has allowed other clients to access. Okay, in NFS, this is done using what's called a mount protocol. Okay, so you take this volume, okay, and you have to mount it on this client for the client to begin accessing the file. In Windows, this is equivalent to creating a network drive. If you use Windows, that's exactly what happens. You take a volume on another machine, you map it to a drive. Okay, it could be a Z drive or whatever drive name you give it. And once you map it, then you can access it that way. Okay? So in most distributed file system, you have to set up this initial mapping. Okay? And that is done in NFS, this is done using mount. So this volume can be mounted at any local point in the subtree on this machine and at any other arbitrary point on another machine. It doesn't matter where you mount it, but once you mount it, then when you traverse this namespace, if you hit this part of the subtree, then all requests, okay, are sent off to the NFS client and then on this machine and then to the server. Okay. Any other files here are handled locally. So these are local files. What is here is a remote file. Okay, so the VFS layer that I talked about will do the resolution, and if it hits this boundary, then it will forward all calls to your client. If it is on this part of the tree, it is going to use a local machine. Okay. Now there is one interesting issue, which is what happens if you have recursive mounts. Okay, so here is an example of what recursive mounts mean. So these are two volumes on the server. Okay. This server has only retrieve this part of the subtree, okay? And this server, okay, has retrieved this part of the subtree, okay? The sort of the whole thing. Okay? Now, if it turns out that this volume is itself mounted by server A from some other machine, okay, then the question is, should these files be available at the client or not? Okay? So, the equivalent of this is, I mount a certain volume, okay, and I export my entire root directory to someone else, and they can access my root directory. Should the file that I mounted also be visible to this third client or not? Or in the second client or not? So this is equivalent of doing recursive mounts. Okay. Now in version 3, there are no transitive exports. This is for a security reason. Okay. Because it is a security loophole. So machine A may trust machine B. Okay. So it allows machine B to access its file. Machine B may trust machine C. So machine B allows C to access its file. But there may be no trust between A and C. Okay. So if you are now allowed transitive mounts, then because A allowed access to some files to B, B might allow access to that file to someone else without the knowledge of A. Okay? And that's a problem. Okay, because you don't know who is accessing your files if you allow recursive mounts or transitive mounts. So crossing of mount points is not allowed in version 3. Version 4 relaxes the trust model some. Okay? It allows you to do in certain cases this transitive mounts, okay, for simplicity reasons, but it can become a security loophole if it is not used properly. If your machines are not configured properly, you might be sharing your files with a friend. Okay. That friend might share their files with someone else and inadvertently also expose your files, okay, if you allow this transitive mounts, which you may not have intended. Okay. So you want to use this mechanism of recursive lookups and crossing of mount points very carefully. So NFS version 4 will allow you to do this, but it also requires that name resolution be handled by the server that is actually exporting the volume. So in other words, if you want to access this file, okay, you don't send the name resolution request here and have A forward it to B because you have now hit this part of the file. So if then B doesn't know that the actual request came from the client. Okay, it only sees a request that's coming from the server. So what is better off is you actually do the name resolution. So if you want to go here, you send that here, and this traverses, and if it hits this one, then you send a request back to the client saying this is another mount volume, go and finish the name resolution at B. And the client actually has to send the name resolution request here and finish the rest. So then the server knows that this client wants to access the file using some transitive mount part. And if it doesn't trust it, it can deny that request. But if you had allowed recursive, this is sort of doing iterative name resolution. If you think about it. If you allowed recursive, B wouldn't even know who made the original request, because it sees the request coming from A. Okay, this has exposed you to the security loophole. Okay, so auto mounting is basically just the mechanism that NFS supports, which is mount on demand, which says these mappings are set up on the fly. Okay, only when you access the files will you actually mount it on demand, and when you are stopped accessing files in the volume, you unmount. Okay, so the mappings are set up dynamically rather than statically. Yeah, because you may have lots of mounts. If you set it up statically, there's a lot of state you have to maintain. Okay. Most modern NFS implementations will support this auto mount. The first time you access a file in the volume, okay, you will basically go and mount that volume. Yeah, I can show, because we have run out of time, I'm going to just show very quick auto mounting. So if we look at, these are all the current devices on this machine. Okay, there is this auto mounter that is actually trying to track requests. Okay, that's called auto home. So what you can do, maybe not, seems to have hung. In private servers. Okay, let okay, so somehow it's not working, just a second. Okay, so they moved the directory somewhere. Okay, so I will. Okay, let me come back to it. I think it has been moved. So I'll show you an example of auto mount next time. Okay, so just to show you that if you have the, what I wanted to show was here right now there's no NFS mounts, but if you actually CD into a directory, it will trap that request and mount things on demand. So I can defer that to the next class. So let me just stop here. We've run out of time. So just one announcement. Actually, two announcements. One is for those of you who came late. There's a project that is out already on the web, so look at it. I can discuss it the next class, right? And the next class being not next Tuesday, the one after that. Next Tuesday, because I'm not here, this discussion on distributed file system will continue, but someone else will do a substitute guest lecture. Okay, so do come. All of that material is part of the course, but I am not the person who's actually going to hold a lecture because I'm traveling on Tuesday. Okay, so keep that in mind. Okay, so let's stop here for today. I will see all of you.